If you're as passionate about human physiology, nutrition, and sport performance as I am, you'll no doubt be excited to learn about Nella. Nella is a performance probiotic clinically validated to improve sleep quality, energy, and digestion. It's made with lactobacillus strains decoded and isolated from the microbiome of the fittest and healthiest people in the modern world. And FitBiomics is offering my listeners a discount. Simply use the code CAS10 at checkout for 10% off your purchase of Nella probiotics. Link below in the show notes. This is the Plant Fueled Podcast. My name is Cass Warbeck. I'm a doctor, plant-based athlete, and vegan lifestyle advocate. This podcast is all about sharing conversations that will elevate your performance and your health. Hey everyone, if you're a regular listener, welcome back. If you're new, thanks for joining. I'm really happy to have you here. So before I jump into my guest introduction, I thought I'd try something a little bit new and share a bit about what's been going on in my life lately. I've noticed that a lot of the podcasts that I personally listen to have hosts who do this regularly, and I enjoy knowing who they are as people, not just who they interview. So basically, I'm trying not to be so private and to open up a little bit about my life. So as you might know, I'm almost through my first year of family medicine residency, and it's been incredible how fast the time has flown. Right now, I'm on my family medicine rotations, so my schedule has been a little more routine as of late, which has allowed me to record more podcasts and be a little bit more consistent with my own training and everything else I'm up to. So that's been very nice, refreshing. I've been trying to get in as much sports medicine experience as I can, as I'm going to be applying for a fellowship in sports and exercise medicine that will follow after my family medicine residency is completed. So I've been pretty busy working on my application for that. Besides this, I've been training as much jiu-jitsu as I can fit in, and I was recently promoted to purple belt, which now allows me to compete at the most advanced level in local competitions, which although I don't necessarily feel like I've earned my purple belt yet, I do want to compete at the highest level I can, so it's overall a good thing from a competitive perspective. I actually competed last weekend, and although I didn't get the outcome I wanted, I feel like this was probably the best thing that could have happened because, as you know, losing makes us better. We learn, we know where we need to improve on, and now I have an idea of what the next level looks like, and I'm excited to improve and see how I do in the next competition. But anyways, I'll continue to share a little bit about my life and interactions from now on, but that's kind of the overview of where I am right now. So that brings me to my guest today, Dr. Matthew Landry, an assistant professor of population health and disease prevention at the University of California. Matthew is truly a force in the field of nutrition, with a passion for promoting plant-forward diets and addressing health disparities. He's a sought-after speaker and has presented his work at conferences internationally. His current research focuses on identifying optimal dietary patterns for chronic disease prevention and addressing the challenges of designing, implementing, and reporting clinical trials that test dietary patterns. He's also a registered dietitian, which allows him to bring the unique perspective of real-world experience to his research. Now, you actually might be familiar with one of his most recent publications, the twin study that was the inspiration behind the Netflix documentary, You Are What You Eat. This was a fascinating trial that compared a vegan diet to an omnivore diet in identical twins. I was really excited to have the opportunity to discuss some of the methods and findings of the twin study in more depth with Matthew today. Beyond this, we chat about whether a keto or Mediterranean diet is better for diabetes, the impact of vegan meat alternatives on athletic performance, and what he's looking forward to studying next. So, please enjoy this conversation with Dr. Matthew Landry. Welcome to the podcast, Matthew. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so excited and glad we could actually make this happen.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you've been involved in so much exciting research. And before we dive into some of the specifics, I was wondering if you'd just mind sharing a little bit about yourself, whatever you feel is important for people to know, maybe your educational background, your work interests, anything you'd like.
Sure. So I'll start from the very beginning. I was born and raised in Southern Louisiana, where I think we have some of the best food. So where food is also part of like culture, it brings us all together. And I think that's what really got me interested in nutrition, because I was eating all this wonderful food, but at the same time, the South of the U.S. has historically had higher rates of chronic diseases across the board. And of course, many of those chronic diseases are a result of poor dietary choices. And so I saw the conflict of those two things. I was loving the food that we were consuming, but at the same time, seeing family members burdened by chronic diseases. And that's really what kickstarted me down the path of, you know, doing research in nutrition and getting several degrees in that. Also along the way, even after doing, you know, getting a PhD in nutrition, I still felt like I didn't know enough. So I became a registered dietitian after that as well. And I think those clinical experiences, even though I don't practice clinically now, still stick with me, you know, and having those one-on-one conversations with someone that just got diagnosed with diabetes or has been suffering with, you know, coronary heart disease for several years now and wanting to finally kind of change their diet, all that still influences my kind of day-to-day work now.
No, that's amazing. It blows my mind that you have a PhD in nutrition and you felt you needed to learn more nutrition. Like, I just want to emphasize that. Like, and that's wild. And people think that nutrition is it's simple, or you get a degree and then you're good to go and you don't need to continuously learn. And I don't know. The thing I've learned about nutrition is that the more I learn, the more I feel I don't know and the more nuance there is with everything. So it's refreshing to hear you say that. What does your current practice look like now? Do you practice privately? Are you mostly research? Like, how do you spend your time?
The majority of my day today is doing research and teaching at the University of California, Irvine. So I teach a public health nutrition class and also a graduate class on nutrition and chronic disease. And then beyond that, I do research. I really focus on promoting food and nutrition security, so a very much public health nutrition focus, making sure that individuals, especially low-income individuals, have access to nutritious foods and how can we eliminate some of those barriers. And then the second part is a little bit more clinical, and that's focusing on preserving cardiovascular health. So what are all the different strategies, not just nutrition, but nutrition being a big part of that, that contribute to preventing cardiovascular disease later down the road.
Wow, very cool. Very cool. So I'm curious, I've known, do you work alongside Christopher Gardner? Like, are you kind of like involved with some, you guys have been co-authored on like several studies together, I believe.
Yeah. So while we're not at the same institution anymore, I did do 3 years of postdoctoral training with Christopher when I was at Stanford. And I still do many kind of collaborations with that kind of team.
Very cool. No, I was kind of doing my background research and looking at some of the articles that you've been involved in, and it's insane. Like, the list just doesn't end. So no, very cool. And I think you're doing a lot to promote like preventative nutrition and address these chronic diseases. That's something I'm very passionate about too. So I'd love to discuss one of your new studies or new research papers. There's a Netflix documentary based on it. So You Are What You Eat, and you are the first author of this twin study research paper that inspired the documentary. I would love if you could just start out by giving a broad overview of the study design and like what you were really interested in looking at.
Yeah. So this actually comes out of the last year of my postdoc. So I spent a year plus really working on this. So I love the project to kind of begin with. But I also got to make sure to give a lot of kudos to the team at Stanford, Christopher Gardner and his team, who really kind of led all of this project. But we were interested in kind of approach to do a study comparing a vegan diet to a healthy omnivorous diet. And we really struggled with that for a second because we were like, there's actually dozens of studies already. We could point them to you where they already have really large sample sizes and they've done it in really rigorous ways. So we really scratched our heads for a long time. And what we came up with was, you know, what's one way that we could help advance the field just one notch further? And a limitation we usually have to put in a lot of our studies is that we couldn't control for genetic factors and things like that, or the environmental factors. And then it kind of stumbled upon us of, oh, what if we did it with identical twins? We could finally control for genetics. We put one twin on a diet and the other twin on a different diet. And ideally, they had that same upbringing, that same background. And for the most part, we can try to control for genetics as much as we can. And that's how we kind of came up with this new study. And it was interesting in the fact that it was part of a documentary. So we still did everything the same way that we would have done the study, regardless of aspects of it being filmed. But it was cool in some part that a little small portion of the twins that were participating got their day-to-day lives filmed. And we have that component of the study as well, where we get to see how they struggle through the diets, what their day-to-day life looked like. And for me, it was kind of eye-opening to kind of see that, sure, I'm, you know, wanting all this data from participants and things like that, but at the end of the day, they're just humans living their day-to-day lives themselves, even though they're contributing to the science.
Yeah, no, it was so fun watching the documentary because it definitely gives like that other side to you download a research paper on PubMed right. and you just like read about the number of subjects. And it's just like these people are just their data points essentially, and they're just numbers. And it was really cool to see the actual people behind that are going through these 4 weeks and then the next 4 weeks and what they liked about it, what they didn't like about it, and just like the human side of it. So that was really fun. How did like the documentary happen?
Yeah, they reached out to my former mentor, Christopher Gardner, and basically said, hey, we want to do this study. And because we think it would be a good addition to have the science, but also the other aspects of the documentary at the same point in time, would y'all be interested? And that also kind of got us down, like I said, down that road of figuring out, okay, what kind of study could we do that actually is novel so that we're doing still good science, not just contributing to a documentary. And yeah.
Very neat. So yeah, anyone listening that hasn't watched the documentary, go watch the documentary. It's very, very entertaining. And like, it's so, you learn so much and you cover so many aspects in it as well. The one thing I wanted to ask you is you mentioned at the beginning that a key feature of this diet was you weren't just comparing a vegan diet to an omnivore diet. It was a healthy omnivore diet. And I think that's a really key distinction to make. Is it fair, and this would be my question to you, is it fair to say that some of the participants would have improved their diet quality regardless of what like arm of the study they were in?
Absolutely. A big thing, we've done several of these studies where it's diet A versus diet B. Mm-hmm. And one of our big things is we want to try to make that as fair of a comparison as possible. We don't want a really poor quality diet compared to kind of this exemplary diet. Of course, we would find, you know, one does better than the other. So we try to make these as fair as possible to say, okay, if we're going to compare this versus this, what are the healthiest, best versions of both of those diets? And we actually saw that, you know, folks on all the twins at baseline, at the very beginning of the study, were consuming omnivorous diets. And so for those that got randomized to the omnivorous, they thought, oh, this is pretty easy. I just do the same thing. Well, not really. We encouraged them. They still met with dietitians and they consumed significantly more whole grains. They consumed significantly more fruits and vegetables as part of their diet. So they themselves, even though they were still on the same diet that they were before, were eating much healthier versions of that diet at the end of the study.
Yeah, and that's fascinating. I think that makes it so important to keep that in mind when you're interpreting all the results, I can imagine. The other question I had is, were the diets designed with a caloric deficit? Like, were participants essentially supposed to lose weight, or was it eat to satiety? Like,
yeah. So in nutrition, there's some studies that are designed to be isocaloric, and we really want to make sure calories are the same across the board. There's a big emphasis on that. In most of our studies, we actually don't care about calories at all. We come from the perspective of that if I told someone to really focus on their diet or something like that, I don't want them calorie counting. That takes the joy out of food. And we never want that in our studies. We want something that's realistic and sustainable. And in that regard, they should be eating until they're satiated. And that's the advice that we told our participants. There was no calorie counts or restrictions or levels or anything like that. We told them, as long as you're eating vegan or as long as you're eating omnivorous, you can eat as much as you want until you're satiated. So in our minds, we never expected any kind of change in weight. One thing that we have noticed in our previous trials is even though we tell folks, eat as much as you want until you're absolutely stuffed, if that's what you want, folks do lose a little bit of weight. We see this across all of our studies, regardless of what diets we do. I think it's just a big reflection of folks are eating less processed foods a lot of times. They're eating more fruits and vegetables, getting full on that, more whole grains, more fiber, all those kind of things. And just a natural byproduct of that is a little bit of weight loss.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then For the methodology of the study, there was 4 weeks where you supplied all the meals to everybody. So the twins got, or the vegan twins got all their meals supplied, the omnivore twins got all their meals supplied. And then the next 4 weeks is they were essentially on their own, but they had to still try and follow the diets, right? Okay. Did you find participants really struggled with that second 4 week phase, or did they do pretty well with it?
Yeah. I think in general, folks do pretty well with that. Of course, I think that dual approach is something novel that we've typically done, and now other teams are kind of following, because we found good success with that, that structured where we are providing all the food, they're able to see, this is what I really should be eating, finding some new flavors, finding some new food combinations that they like. I think that's really helpful and critical. And it does lead into that kind of new experience of, okay, now I'm in charge of preparing all these foods. Our study was pretty short. It was only 8 weeks in total, and only 4 weeks was that second half where they were on their own. So I think that first two or so weeks where they were on their own, they might have struggled a little bit finding those new recipes. But again, we had dietitians on hand giving them that support. So I think by and large, they did quite well with that. And certainly, you know, if the study would have been a lot longer by, you know, 2 or 3 months down the road, I think they would have been smooth sailing.
Okay. That makes sense. And then it also just makes it so much more real life, like too, like you were saying, you don't get them to calorie count. Well, now they get to just like actually live their lives, and kind of it makes the results seem so much more like applicable to the general population and people that might want to try these diets. So,
right.
Yeah, I think that's definitely important.
Absolutely.
Okay. The other question I had before we jump into the results is, in the documentary, the participants were also doing an exercise program. Were all the sets of twins doing exercise, or were just the twins that were part of the documentary doing the exercise?
Yeah. So that was a component that was strictly only for the twins that were part of the documentary. So that is one kind of deviation. Mm-hmm. We controlled for that in our analysis. We didn't find any kind of differences, but those twins were participating in that rigorous, more physical activity intervention.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Okay. What were the main results, I guess? Like, what were you specifically looking at?
So our main outcome was LDL cholesterol, sometimes called our bad cholesterol, and changes in that over 8 weeks. And what we found was that twins assigned to the vegan diet had significantly lower LDL cholesterol at 8 weeks compared to the twins on the healthy omnivorous diet. We also saw decreases in weight, again, very small amounts, and decreases in insulin among the vegan twins compared to omnivorous.
Very good. So those are all essentially markers of like improved cardiovascular health and improved, like, all good things. What I wanted to kind of ask about is, what's the significance of the decrease in the fasting insulin? Like, just for people that aren't really sure what that really means. I think most people know what like the LDL bad cholesterol is, but fasting insulin is something that we don't really see quite so often.
Right. And that was a surprise finding. Again, we weren't really expecting that so much. I think it's just a reflection of having potentially more fiber in their diet, more vitamins and minerals. I'm not really sure what's kind of explaining that. We weren't really expecting it. And I would say the change in that one was quite small, but it was significant. So it was one of our findings.
Fair. And this is me just trying to learn here, is fasting insulin, is that something that we would see, dysfunction in or abnormalities in potentially before we actually see changes in glucose levels, like fasting glucose and random glucose and like other markers of diabetes? Do you think it's an early indicator?
That I'm not quite sure about. Again, we didn't really see any changes in glucose. Those were quite the same between baseline and 8 weeks. But we did see that big decrease, the decrease in the vegan twins for insulin.
Okay.
So certainly kind of an area to maybe do a little bit more kind of exploration.
Yeah, no, I feel like this study is just like a launching point for so many other things to look into. Yeah, very exciting. I wanted to ask about one of the criticisms that I've heard of the study. I'm sure there's been lots, but one of the ones just I heard is that the LDL cholesterol can sometimes just go down because of weight loss. And they were saying that the vegans eat a little bit less than the omnivores. So it's hard to kind of tease out, like, was it the vegan diet or was it the weight loss and just the calorie deficit? And I was just wondering, like, how you kind of address that or how you explain that.
Sure. And it could be a result of the weight loss. That's always something there. I think there's always a challenge of making sure that the study is, like, rigorous and generalizable at the same time. Could we have made sure that diets were completely isocaloric, exactly the same, so that we prevented and saved off any kind of weight loss? And we could have, you know, matched the diets for numerous kind of variables. At the end of the day, it starts getting kind of challenging to do all those kind of similarities. So that is kind of a caveat that we did have to kind of point out that, yeah, we saw some weight loss and some decrease in LDL cholesterol could have been a result of that weight loss. I don't think it would be across the board all a result of that small little change in weight that we see between the two different diets. Again, one thing that we saw is a significant drop in LDL cholesterol as even as early as just 4 weeks as a result of the diets. So again, we weren't really seeing the weight loss at that earliest kind of stage. It is a limitation of our particular study, but I think our results still hold. And I think when we look at the larger literature, again, as we should be doing with any study, we do see these significant drops in LDL cholesterol on a vegan diet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was going to point out as well. So it's not like this is something that's not supported by their literature. Right. Yeah. And I feel like the fact that the vegans ate less calories and they were still eating to feel satisfied, like, that's a strength of the study. That just goes to show that you can maybe lose weight without even trying and become satiated on, like, less calories with a plant-based diet versus an omnivore diet. So I feel definitely you could argue the other way too. Was there, in conducting the study and being part of this whole project, was there anything that surprised you, like, about some of these main results? Or did you go in thinking it might be different or you might see different things?
Yeah. I think for us, we kind of went to it expecting to see what we saw based on everything else in the research. I don't think at all this is a groundbreaking kind of study, like maybe some of the headlines were kind of pointing out. I think the only really cool thing about this is the twins themselves. It's so rare to see a nutrition study that is able to control for this kind of factor. I would love to see more of them. And maybe this will kind of open the door for more researchers to kind of do these twin studies. But that was really kind of the novel part of this. One thing that we didn't really see a significant change in was TMAO, trimethylamine oxide. As one of our particular outcomes, we have seen a decrease in that clinical kind of marker in some of our other studies that have involved kind of more plant-based diets, but we didn't see it in this one. We do have a couple of hypotheses of kind of why that is. It really could be just the small kind of sample size and the variability in that kind of clinical measure. But at least we didn't see a significant difference in this study.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. And then some in the documentary, there were other, like, secondary outcomes that weren't necessarily reported in your main, like, cardiovascular study that I was reading. And I don't know if some of these were more, like, talked about in the documentary for novelty or if this is something that there's going to be other papers coming out on. But one of the things was that participants had to provide stool samples and you were actually analyzing the gut microbiota. So I'm curious, like, just thoughts on, like, did you see anything interesting with those results? Or what was the going on there?
Yeah. So what we could fit in that one paper that got published in JAMA Network Open, it's only a small little sample. Even then, we squeezed as much as we could in the journal.
It's a dense paper.
This is too much. Put half of it in the supplement. And, you know, we pushed back as much as we could. But some of it will be kind of future studies that are coming out. One of the big ones, it will be the microbiome paper. We worked with a great team at Stanford that was led by the Sonnenbergs, husband and wife kind of combo team, who is really leading up that portion. That's their kind of expertise. But I'll just kind of give a teaser that we do have some significant results there. They do generally kind of favor the vegan diet compared to healthy omnivores, like you see in kind of the documentary. But That's to come.
Okay, I will wait for that paper then. One of the other biomarkers was telomere length and just biological aging. And that really surprised me because in an 8-week study, to even think that you could like see a difference between groups at that time is really surprising. So again, like what can you share what you found?
Yeah, so I'll preface this with like, this is not my area, coming from nutrition. Fair. And I think if you were to watch the documentary in the very beginning, my mentor Christopher says the same thing. He doesn't expect telomere length to change at all. It's a new kind of marker for us to even look at in one of our trials. We do see a difference, and that was kind of highlighted in the documentary. I think we would maybe need to view this with a grain of salt. I think this is still a very much emerging kind of area of study. And I think at the end of the day, maybe one twin is estimated to live, you know, a fraction of a minute longer than their other twin. So how much do we really, you know, need to weigh this in the fact of course of lives and other behaviors that we really could make much larger differences? That would be my kind of impression on this, but I think it's a kind of cool area in some ways to think about.
Yeah, no, definitely. You summed it up very well there. I feel like there's a lot better things to focus our attention on if we really want to live longer, but that's very cool. I think Christopher Gardner was talking about this too. And like when you have, it's kind of rare to, like you say, to have like 22 sets of twins and be able to analyze all these things. So it kind of makes sense to just collect as much data as possible and then analyze it later, right?
Right. You know, we did try to collect as much as possible and look at some of those health outcomes. But the only downside to that too is we didn't want this to be a fishing experiment. We want to go in very intentional to say, these are the things based on research otherwise. That we would expect to actually change as a result of diet. So it's always the balance of those two things of knowing, you know, those important measures to do, and then maybe one or two kind of novel things and kind of stretch the field a little bit as well.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Is there anything looking back now, would you have done differently in the methodology, or do you wish you had collected some sort of data that you didn't, or are you pretty happy with overall how it went?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we wish we would have done, you know, it really comes down to kind of a limitation on time, budget, and things, is that in the documentary, that the four sets of twins had DEXA scans done at baseline, I think at 4 weeks and then 8 weeks as well, for sure at baseline at 8 weeks, to see changes in body composition. So if they were losing weight, you know, what kind of weight was it? Was it fat or muscle, whatever it is? We did not do that on all the twins. So when we see a decrease in weight in the vegan twins, we can't say what type of weight was lost there. And now kind of looking back, I wish we would have looked at body composition. Again, we went into the study not thinking twins were going to really change all that much. And again, overall, I don't think they changed weight all that much, but it would be interesting to look and see with that weight loss, was it fat or was it muscle?
Yeah, no, that would have been interesting for sure. Cause I think that's kind of something that's debated a lot. And it's like, oh, you need like the high protein diet to avoid losing all your muscle when you lose weight. So yeah, something to explore in the future more, I think.
For sure.
Regardless, I think it was a very, very in-depth study and yeah, very exciting to read and to watch the documentary. I want to talk about a couple of your other research studies that you've been into. Okay. But before, I was kind of just wondering, my impression of you is that you're very plant-forward, plant-based. Like that's kind of the diet ideology, I guess, you promote. And I'm just wondering, like, do you feel like a completely plant-based diet is a gold standard that people should aim for? Or do you think like 80%, 90% plant-based is like good enough for health outcomes? I guess this is more a personal opinion question, but just like kind of what's your stance on diet?
Yeah. I like to encourage or nudge folks in the direction of plant-based diets. You know, I think we see benefits not just related to health, but also just for the environment as well when we go more plant-based. And so do I think folks need to all follow a whole food, plant, vegan diet? No, Probably not. And I don't think we're going to get folks there, at least probably in my lifetime, I would imagine some strong resistance against that. But I think even just incremental steps in that direction can have significant impacts on health, have significant impacts on the environment. So, you know, even just taking steps in that direction where you consume maybe, you know, half your meals at least in a week, that's a good step in the right direction. Can we nudge people even further than that? Maybe so. You know, do 80, 90% of those meals. I think sometimes our environments aren't always structured to support that as best as possible. But I think we're starting to lean more in that direction. I'll give you just an example. I consume of a largely plant-based diet, with exception of when I'm traveling. I find that some of the hardest times to really stay plant-based, especially sometimes I fly into smaller airports where the only kind of plant-based option is like a chicken Caesar salad or something like that, where, okay, I don't eat chicken. So then I'm just going to have some romaine lettuce with a little bit of salad dressing. I'm going to be hungry in 30 minutes. So there, I might get just a sandwich or something like that, that isn't plant-based, to kind of, you know, make sure that I stay, you know, full. But then I sometimes fly into airports where they have some really awesome plant-based options. And, you know, if that was the default where that's widely available, then I think it makes it a lot easier for folks to make that decision to do plant-based.
Mm-hmm. That makes perfect sense. And especially like given your major research interest is like this overarching like public health, like this big lens perspective, I completely agree with you. I feel like if everyone just like shifted more toward the plant-based side of the spectrum, like the world would be so much better off. Health outcomes would be so much better. So yeah, no, that makes complete sense to me. I'm very much a similar mindset. I'm completely vegan myself, but in like the way I talk to patients, the way I talk to friends and family members, it's really just like whatever you can do to eat more plants, eat more fiber, eat less processed foods, like all these things are moving in the right direction. And I feel like people get kind of scared off when it's like, oh, completely vegan for the rest of my life. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be that way. You have the public health research perspective. And then there's also, obviously you mentioned like a ton of disease prevention overall. Mm-hmm. And so, and with the twin study, we're looking at cardiovascular disease outcomes and some of those biomarkers. But another like major disease that ravages society is type 2 diabetes and the whole metabolic syndrome and all those things that go along with that. So one of the studies that you were involved in was a randomized controlled trial comparing a ketogenic diet to a Mediterranean diet, I believe. And yeah. I believe, I'm not as familiar with the study, but I think that both of them were a little bit more low carb, but the Mediterranean diet included legumes and whole grains and actually fruit. And you were looking at outcomes like hemoglobin A1C, I believe. And I just wanted to address this one and talk about it a little bit because so often with my patients, and it's just like low carb seems to be like the default. And like everyone thinks they have to, can never eat grains, can never eat fruit. And yeah. I would just love to ask a PhD nutritionist what he thinks about this.
Yeah. That was a fun study. That's our Keto Med study, compares a ketogenic versus Mediterranean diet. And we might think those diets are complete opposite sides of the room, but there's actually a lot of similarities across both of them.
Which really surprised me because like people do think they're like completely opposite and that there's like no overlap. But yeah, sorry right. to interrupt, but go on.
Because at the end of the day, like you said, they both really encourage not having added sugar, refined grains, or, you know, those components. But the Mediterranean does lean a little bit heavier in encouraging those legumes, those fruits, and some of those whole grains. So what we really compared those two diets on, like you said, HbA1c among individuals with prediabetes and diabetes. And what we found was that they both, at the end of the day, resulted in significant changes in HbA1c. We saw decreases in that. We did see some negative impacts of the ketogenic diet on LDL cholesterol and LDL cholesterol. And we saw better adherence with the Mediterranean diet. I think that just is a result of being more flexible. But in general, I think having fewer carbohydrates did help these individuals.
Okay, that's interesting. With these individuals in these diets, did you have them calorie counting and carbohydrate counting, or was it also similar to the twin study that you just like kind of gave them guidelines and told them what to eat and they were able to free live and eat to satiety?
Similar vibe with this study. We didn't have calorie restrictions or anything like that.
Okay, so the people in the Mediterranean group could essentially eat fruit and have beans and have some grains. And yeah, that was, did you limit them to how much fruit they could eat?
We did limit them to how much fruit. We can still stay within kind of those guidelines from the American Diabetes Association, which does still encourage fruit. It, even though we do want to limit carbohydrate intake with persons with diabetes, you can still have fruit. They're still in a really critical, important part of our diet.
Okay, that's good to know. And I'm going to be passing this message along to patients that have diabetes and feel they can't eat any carbohydrates. And in your opinion, do you feel that the sugar and the glucose found in fruit and the fructose is different from like white sugar or like some of these other like processed foods? Like, does it interact in the body differently?
I definitely think so. I really think it's about thinking about that entire kind of food matrix. And this is, a very common thing that I saw when I was in clinical practice, that folks with diabetes would say, oh, I can't have fruit or I can't have these things, even though they are nutritious because it has sugar. And I think it's really about educating that, yeah, when we consume fruits, they do have that natural sugar that's built in, but there's also fiber in that same fruit. And that fiber helps slow down that rise in our blood glucose and helps, you know, mute it much more than if we're just having a tablespoon of, you know, pure sugar itself. And that really makes a difference at the end of the day. And, you know, when we're eating fruits, we're still getting lots of those vitamins and minerals that are also really important towards our health. So we still want to consume them just, you know, as part of a variety of a diet.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. As a registered dietitian, I'm sure you probably get asked all the time, what is the best diet for diabetes? And I'm just curious how you'd answer this, even in light of like the Keto Med study or trial. Like, do you, is it very personalized or is there specific recommendations that you give to clients and patients?
Yeah. I would probably lean heavy towards the Mediterranean diet. I think it's really widely kind of accepted, has some strong benefits. The only downside is, you know, the Mediterranean diet, even though it's considered the best kind of diet, you know, on several kind of scales, I think the name throws folks really off and they, you know, gravitate towards certain pictures that they might see that aren't really depictions of, you know, what's consumed in the Mediterranean region. I could probably go on and on about that. But at the end of the day, it is really great that it promotes lots of fruits and vegetables, lots of whole grains, and those fruits and vegetables in general, and really reductions in added sugar, refined grains. And I think that's actually a common aspect of many diets. So rather than giving folks one name kind of diet, this is what you should follow, I think it's better to talk about those important tenets, you know, lots of whole grains, lots of fruits and vegetables, let's cut down on the process and refine things. And that's a better way to kind of talk about diet.
Yeah. And that makes sense as well. I think a Mediterranean diet, you're right, the term gets thrown around. And I think in our guidelines, like that's recommended for heart health, all these different things. Right. And so just to clarify, I know you alluded to it a bit, but how do you describe like a Mediterranean diet that like, does it include like poultry? Does it include fish? Like what kind of, I think most people understand that it's rich in like the fruits and the vegetables, but like it's some of that other gray area that like, what would you feel is included?
Yeah. I probably have a little bit of bias that I'm going to encourage folks to really move towards more of those plant-based protein sources. I largely work in the cardiovascular space. So I use the American Heart Association's recommendations, which encourage our protein sources to be coming from mostly plants. That's in their most recent dietary statement. But if we are consuming, you know, animal-based protein sources, then we want those lean sources primary. So maybe we're going to still get some seafood, get some of those essential kind of fatty acids that are so good for us. Or we might choose poultry sources and, you know, really trying to stick away more from those red meat sources, which include pork as part of that.
Okay, got you. Okay. And another diet study I wanted to ask you about was like you've been involved in so much exciting research, but was the swap meet athlete trial. So I like this one in particular because I, as we were talking about a little bit before, like I do like the athletic performance side of it and striving not just for health, but like for best performance, whether that's in like sport or just in life in general or showing up your best every day. So I thought this one was really fascinating. And you can explain better than me, but you were essentially comparing three different diets. You were comparing a diet that included meat to two different plant-based diets, if I'm right here. One was a whole food plant-based diet and one had some meat alternatives, which so like Beyond Beef or Impossible Burger, I think, right? Do you want to just like explain the study a little bit better than I am here? And then I can ask some follow-up questions.
Sure. So this was a follow-up study that was done by one of our master students, Aubrey Roberts, who's now a PhD student at Stanford, from our swap meat study itself, which looked at plant-based meat alternatives versus animal meats in that particular study. But this one, we had the three dietary comparisons, because one of the things that we found is that if you put folks on a completely plant-based meat alternative so that all they're consuming is Beyond Meat, Impossible, things like that, they actually get tired of that after a little while. There's just not, even though the marketplace has now a variety of those kind of things, at the end of the day, it starts to get a little tiring. We don't have that variety. And they are, you know, there's some pushback that they're processed. So we decided to tack on that third arm where it's really the whole food plant-based product, foods where we're really going after those kind of really natural or less processed options. And we looked at 12 recreational either runners or resistant trainers to really see, you know, based on their diet, do we see any kind of changes in athletic kind of performance? Because that's a big hurdle sometimes for those folks that, you know, really enjoy being physically active, that they don't want to change their diet and see some kind of decrease in either the amount of weight that they're able to lift or, you know, the distance and the speed that they're able to go. And at the end of the day, when we compared those three diets, we really didn't see any difference in athletic performance, regardless of the diets.
Okay. That's reassuring, I think, because again, and I don't know where this came from, probably the meat industry, but all these plant-based alternatives, these meat alternatives, these burgers, these meatballs, and they got like essentially everything now, like you were saying, they get criticized all the time for being like high in sodium, high in like they have processed oil in them. They're just like a processed food and like it's garbage compared to your grass-fed beef sort of thing. And I think this study is really cool showing that actually, no, this might not necessarily be a bad thing. What are your, I guess, outside of the study, what are your thoughts on like plant-based meat alternatives and how do you see them fitting into a healthy diet?
Yeah. In my opinion, as long as we're not consuming them, like this is all we're consuming every day, you know, several meals a day, I think they have actually a place in our diet, especially for those folks, as we were talking about earlier, that are making that transition and that shift towards a more plant-based diet. What I like to give, one of my favorite recipes that's vegan is a lentil chili. Really delicious, very satiating, will keep you full for a while. If I have someone that's typically consuming just regular ground beef or whatever kind of animal-based chili, if I want to move them in that direction, getting them to jump into lentil chili might be a little bit of a stretch. But if I can start them on some, you know, Impossible or Beyond Meat ground beef, and using that to really make sure that the texture's as close as possible to the same, that could be this kind of gateway into a more kind of plant-based diet. And they can see, oh, this isn't so bad. Oh, I still feel satiated. Oh, it's pretty much the same thing. And then they can start moving into, oh, let me try some lentils, you know, do half and half or something. So it's that gradual approach. And so I think that's where really some of these meat alternatives play the biggest role, is part of this intermediate step before going into a fully kind of more plant-based diet.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I also, even just for myself, like I love the lentils, I love the black beans, like the tofu, the tempeh, but it's fun to have alternatives sometimes. And I heard someone say once that it's like they aren't vegan or they didn't become plant-based because they hated how their food tasted. And I thought that was very powerful. It's like you can become like predominantly plant-based for environmental reasons, ethical reasons. You might just want to be a little bit healthier. It's not because you inherently all of a sudden wake up one day not liking how your burger tastes. So I think that's, it's good to have options for people. And the more options we have, like it empowers people to kind of make their own health decisions and choices.
Right.
What do you say when people ask you like, well, the Beyond Burger is processed. Does that mean it's bad? Like, what is your response to that?
Yeah. I think at the end of the day, it really comes down to that. It depends. What is the comparison that we're looking at? Is someone really consuming this every day, for every single meal? Chances are no. So if we're trying to have those different kind of meals scattered throughout the, you know, a typical dietary pattern, I don't think see a lot of hesitance to kind of be able to recommend that.
Okay, makes sense. And kind of coming back to like the athlete side of it and these recreational runners and resistance athletes, I guess the main takeaway from the study is that like on the plant-based diet, that they didn't lose any performance and like everyone was basically the same across the board, right? Yeah. So is that overall reassuring, like for athletes that are thinking about going vegan, that they can go plant-based and go vegan without being so much like worried about their athletic performance? Like, is that a fair kind of conclusion to draw from the study here?
Yeah, I think that is quite fair. We did see decreases in protein intake on both of the more plant-based diets. But one of the things I would say, at least here in the US, is we consume way too much protein to begin with. They put protein in everything nowadays. And we don't need quite that much protein for just, you know, general health and well-being, even as an athlete. So I think we can still do these dietary patterns. Does someone that is exercising regularly or more of an athlete want to go completely vegan without kind of some kind of good guidance, either from a registered dietitian or someone that's really knowledgeable about nutrition? I think that shift can be a challenge to make sure that they're still getting all the nutrients that they need, but it is certainly possible to do.
Okay. Makes sense. And I agree with kind of that as well. And I think it's so nuanced and there's so many different levels of sport and people right. that are trying to maintain weight versus not maintain weight or lose weight. And it's not one size fits all, but yeah, no, that's reassuring. Very good conclusion from that. A kind of follow up to like all this research I've been drilling you on is I'm very curious, like what's next for you? What are you involved in currently? Or do you have, you probably have a ton of research projects on the go, but like, what are you excited about right now?
Yeah. So I just had a project funded by the American Heart Association to actually look at first time fathers and their changes in lifestyle behaviors as they become a father.
Oh, no way.
So how does their diet, sleep, physical activity, and some clinical measurements, like their weight, cholesterol, glucose, all those change as they become fathers. So their life goes from, you know, I'm able to eat what the foods I want, work out when I want, and then suddenly a toddler enters their life and wrecks their sleep schedule, wrecks their diet. How does that impact all of them? I think we focus a lot on maternal and child health and sometimes mm-hmm. forget there's a dad in that equation sometimes. And how does his health really change during this really major life event? And so that project is just getting started. And I'm really excited to kind of see the results from that.
Yeah, that's fascinating, actually, because you're so right. We focus so much on like, oh, the mother's not getting any sleep. Like she's got like her calories and all these things and her weight, but that's fascinating. I'm curious, when you're studying these fathers or fathers-to-be, how early are you starting like kind of your data collection? Are you starting it before like their baby's even born, or is it kind of like start like once this baby's in their life?
Yeah, we're starting as early as we can. I'm trying to get them during their spouse's second trimester if possible. That way we get that pre-pregnancy. What does life look like at least, you know, before baby and things really get hectic? But the majority of what we're following them is post-pregnancy. But we do want at least one pre-birth kind of measurement.
That's exciting. Well, I'm very excited to kind of see the results of that. I feel like I've been drilling you on so many like different things kind of bouncing all over the place, but just to switch topics one more time here. I was reading that you're also involved with the Obesity Society. And my simple question to this is, I believe like you do some speaking for them. And I'm just wondering, like, what is the biggest misconception that people have about obesity? And I guess like we don't have too much time remaining here, but what is like one overarching message that you'd want to convey like from that perspective?
Yeah. I think one of the biggest things is that people really think that obesity is caused purely by just a poor diet and no physical activity. And the reality is that obesity is a complex and chronic disease that really needs to be taken seriously, just as, you know, any other illness or disease. And that sometimes it can be caused by genetics or medications or other diseases, and that there's numerous factors and situations that are going into this. So purely telling someone to, you know, eat a healthier diet and, you know, move their body more can help. And we know those can be effective lifestyle interventions, but oftentimes that's not the full case for many individuals as well.
Okay. Yeah. I thought you might say something to that point. And it's something that I've even recognized within patients. And it seems like people are just doing all the right things or trying really hard. And it's not an easy one size fits all solution. So yeah, I wish we had time to get into. I'm sure that's a completely different conversation. But thank you for sharing that. Kind of as we like close out here, I do want to I'll direct everyone to where they can find you. But as I was looking you up, I know your handle on Instagram is The Dietitian. I think I'm saying that correctly. Okay. I'm just genuinely curious, how and why did you choose that handle?
Yeah. I think it was largely because when I was coming through my nutrition and dietetics program, a lot of times I was the only guy in the room. And I think that's kind of across our profession at large. It is primarily female driven. And I thought there was kind of that niche area that every time I walked into the room, they were like, oh, a guy here. And someone mentioned it at some point that, oh, maybe you're the dietitian. And I was like, that's pretty clever. And so I ran with that.
It is clever, actually. No, I like it. Do you find that you have like men reaching out to you that maybe they are reaching out to you because you're a guy versus like a female dietitian? Like, do you get more of your clientele from that like demographic?
Again, I don't practice very heavily.
Yeah, I guess so.
But when I have chatted with some guys, or even other just like male dietitians that are in clinical practice, I think sometimes it is helpful to just see a male dietitian and hear kind of our perspectives. One of my big things is I never like to be hungry because I personally get hangry. So anytime I give recommendations, I make sure that they leave thinking that they don't really always need to cut calories, but we can focus on other aspects of their diet and that they don't have to be feeling hangry and things like that, or that they have to have a portion size that, you know, is about the size of their palm and that's all they get to eat. You know, I think as guys, sometimes we do love to eat and don't like someone telling us, no, you can only have small portions. So I always go at least into that mindset personally with some of the male clients that I work with.
I really like that, actually, because you're so right. If like you meet someone for the first time and you're telling them that their protein has to be the palm of their hand.
Yep.
And they're gonna
have snack,
to...
you can only have some carrots and a little bit of hummus.
Yeah, you got to count your almonds. Like, that's no fun. No, I like that. That's super cool. As we close out here, and I, again, very much appreciate your time. What is one thing that you'd like people listening to take away from this conversation, or one lasting message or something that I should have asked you that I didn't? Just open floor.
Yeah. Again, you know, at the end of the day, you might see in the headlines a lot of this diet A versus diet B, those things. When we really look at it, a lot of our diets across the board have a lot of similarities. And what we know from, you know, a plethora of research is that it really comes down to not the name of the diet or this or that or how much of this or that. It's really, you know, eat more vegetables, eat more whole grains, and really reduce that added sugar and refined kind of products. That at the end of the day makes some of the biggest impacts on cardiovascular disease, diabetes, across the board.
So it's all the boring things. You don't have a bad name for it, right? The things we've been hearing about for years and years. I like that. Yep. It's simple. No, that's really great. So if anyone's listening, they want to reach out, they want to connect with you, find you on social media, dig through some of your research papers, where would you direct them to?
Yeah, you can check out either my Instagram or my Twitter X kind of handle at The Dietitian, or check out my faculty page at the University of California, Irvine.
Okay, perfect. And I will definitely link to all those in the show notes below. So everyone, you can just scroll down and click on those. And I'll also link to a couple of the studies that we specifically talked about. So you can find them on PubMed and read through all the details for yourself. But yeah, thank you very much for being here, Matthew. I feel like I could have dove into much more of your research, but no, I really appreciate this and I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's all for now. Thank you for listening and I hope it was valuable to you. Please remember to check out the show notes for all the resources mentioned and links to connect with our guest. If you would like to support what I'm doing, the best way to help me grow the show is to subscribe, of course, but also share it with your friends and family or on social media. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, you can also leave a 5-star review and or a comment. A special thank you, as always, to Tyler Gatto for composing the theme music for the podcast and to Wyatt Pavlik for the excellent audio engineering each and every episode. So until next time, keep training hard, keep eating plants, and take care.